Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 71, Reflections of a Therapist Who is Gay, January 14, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So when I was young, the Holocaust was happening, and it was ghastly. One of my early memories, I mean, I was of age, I remember very clearly when refugees started coming over from Europe when I was about 10 years old, and how horrible it was. And then during, I remember when the Second World War started, and Germany invaded Poland, and I had relatives who died in the gas chambers in Poland. Well, as for a Jew, the Holocaust is a ghastly experience. Well, then later in life, here I am practicing as a therapist with clientele, one-third of whom were gay, and with a gay group. And the AIDS epidemic comes along. One of the first 25 people who was listed as having died from AIDS was one of my patients. And in New York City and San Francisco, I think those were the two hardest hit. Well, it was ghastly. It was like another kind of Holocaust.
That was the voice of longtime Gestalt therapist and author Dr. Daniel Rosenblatt. Dr. Daniel Rosenblatt has two books being published this year in Germany, Your Life is a Mess and What to Do About It, and The Demystification of Therapy, as well as a U.S. publication of Between Men, a book about working with gay men. He also may have an off-Broadway production of a play, Unfinished Business, about the similarities between what happens in a therapist's office and in his personal life. His previous books include Opening Doors, What Happens in Gestalt Therapy, and The Gestalt Therapy Primer. Dr. Rosenblatt has degrees in history, sociology, and clinical psychology from Wayne State University, Columbia University, and Harvard University. He's held staff or faculty positions at the Bureau of Study Council, Harvard University, the Russian Research Center, Harvard University, McLean Hospital, Harvard Medical Center, Bank Street College of Education, Teachers College, Columbia University, and Brooklyn College, City University of New York, Downstate Medical Center, and New York University School of Social Work. Finally, he's conducted training workshops in Germany, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Dan Rosenblatt, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. Really glad.
Well, here I am.
Yeah, glad to have you here. First of all, I should let our listeners know that I was referred to you by Dr. John Drimmer, who was my guest on this show about two episodes ago, and John suggested you would make a terrific guest, and he told me that you were his therapist years ago and have been a mentor and a friend ever since, and he gave me a lot of background on you and suggested issues I should explore. And
well, that's all true.
Okay, you've had a long and distinguished and multifaceted career. In fact, John mentioned that you're in your 80s, so you have had a long and a distinguished and a multifaceted career. And there's so many different areas that we could explore, but we aren't going to have time to go down all the possible pathways. So my questions are going to focus on your long experience as a Gestalt therapist who also happens to be gay. So,
Right. So
let's start at the beginning. Which for me is, when did you first realize that you were gay?
It's so long ago, it's hard to reconstruct. It was There are a lot of people who know very early. I had some patients who told me they knew they were gay when they were 5 and 6.
Yes, and that's what I was wondering.
And I didn't. I have a twin brother, and he's straight. And he's also in his 80s. And we grew up together, of course. And at that time, it was in Detroit, Michigan. It was not cool to be gay. And whatever intimations I may have had, and they were few and far between, I pushed them aside. So I think, I think it wasn't until I was through undergraduate school that...
I'm fascinated by the fact that you have a twin brother, I believe an identical twin, isn't that right?
That's right.
So you've got the same genetics, and you had the same environmental exposure. So how do you account for, or is there something known in the literature for how this would come about?
Well, I don't think there's anything in the literature, and my own non-scientific guess is that identical twins aren't necessarily identical. He's right-handed and I'm left-handed. And he's straight and I'm gay. And we had the same environment, and he came out of the womb first. But, you know, I don't know that identical means identical in the sense of, do we really know that all the genes are the same?
It's making me wonder, how do you know that you were identical twins as opposed, isn't it sometimes happened that I have fraternal twins, and they certainly looked alike in the early days, but do you know for sure that you guys were properly classified as identical twins?
Well, we were always told that by psychologists and by doctors and so on, and you know, people always mistake him for me, although, again, he's a little bit taller than I am, maybe as much as a half inch. But people always meet him on the street and think he's me, or vice versa.
Okay. Well, let's come back to some of our other issues around being a therapist and so on. When did you first realize you wanted to become a psychologist/therapist? Or is that going back too far again?
No, I studied psychology as an undergraduate, but my major was history, and my degree was in history. And then I got a master's degree from Columbia University in history. But it was, after I got the master's degree, I was in therapy with Laura Perls.
Oh, yes, the wife of Fritz Perls, founders of Gestalt Therapy.
They started Gestalt Therapy with Paul Goodman. Mm-hmm. And I was presumably Laura's second or third patient in America. So I was in therapy with her for about 2.5 years, and then I went to Harvard to get a PhD, and I started in history, and it turned out that all the topics I was writing papers about really were psychologically oriented. I remember I was doing a psychoanalytic study of William Gibbon had left 6 autobiographical fragments, and I was doing a psychoanalytic interpretation of his autobiographical fragments. I remember my professor said he thought this was very interesting, but he had no way of judging it as historical material.
Mm-hmm.
So this was happening in all of the history courses I was taking. My interest, it seemed clear to me, after the work with Laura Perls, was much more psychological, so I switched from the history department to what Harvard then had called the social relations department. It was right after the Second World War, and it was an attempt to integrate the social sciences. You had to take courses in clinical psychology, social psychology, social anthropology, and sociology, and you had to become proficient in all of them. Now, the department didn't last because there was so much bureaucratic infighting among the leaders of the different divisions that after about 8 years it broke up. And meanwhile, that was the period that I was there taking courses in all those different disciplines. And I thought it was valuable and useful. But anyway, that's when I switched from being a historian to being a social scientist, particularly a clinical psychologist.
Okay, so there you are at some point in a doctoral program in clinical psychology at Harvard. And did your professors know that you were gay during that period?
Yes, and they didn't like it at all. It was the 1950s, and they were very hostile and unfriendly, unsympathetic, ununderstanding. And they also didn't care about Gestalt therapy either. I told them I had been in therapy with Laura Pearls, and she was a Gestalt therapist, and they said there was no such thing. There's Gestalt psychology in Germany. There's no Gestalt therapy. And I said, well, that's not my experience. And they said, well, we're telling you.
Oh,
and
boy.
So I thought, if I have to survive here, I have to shut my mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, so how, you know, and during that period, according to the diagnostic manual of that time, homosexuality was listed as a psychopathology. So how did you manage to get through that? That sounds terribly challenging.
Well, it was challenging and it was tough and it was difficult, and I did not have the support of the faculty, and that was a great struggle and a terrible time in ways.
Oh, yeah. Was there ever any question that your degree would be blocked?
Well, there was, but then they seemed to relent. I think they were so ambivalent about it themselves because, you know, on the one hand, officially, it was psychopathology. On the other hand, God knows how many people on the Harvard faculty were gay already, and how many of their colleagues they knew were in the closet. So It was, you know, the same old hypocrisy going on, and so officially they were hostile, and unofficially I think some of them were friendly. One of the people who was very kind to me, I just saw a notice today, I had forgotten he had died, Frederick Mosteller. He was the statistician who first applied statistics to social science data. And he was very important to bring quantitative data to social science, and he was very kind to me about it. So there were, you know, individuals, but as a institution, it was terrible.
Yeah.
And there were, you know, suicides, you know, professors who were outed would kill themselves and so on. It was not a good time.
Oh, yes, very tragic. So at what point did you come out as a therapist who was gay?
Well, after the therapy with Laura Pearls, although I experimented with heterosexuality and had girlfriends and relationships and so on, but it was clear to me that my preference was really for men.
Mm-hmm.
I just, with, you know, she and Fritz came from Berlin in the 20s and 30s in the Weimar Republic. And those people didn't give a damn about whether anybody was gay or not. I mean, they really saw people as human beings and individuals. And it was that they came from a different culture and a different background. And most of their friends in New York were gay. So it was such an accepting environment that I just felt more comfortable accepting that this was who I was and that it had its own dignity and value despite what the prevailing mores in the larger culture were. And in New York City, in bohemian circles, and they were anarchists, nobody cared. So it was not difficult to say, well, this is who I am and this is where I belong.
And then did you rather quickly begin to develop a clientele?
No, I was, people used to say when I was at Harvard, what do you want to do? Do you want to teach, do you want to do research, or do you want to do therapy? And I said, well, I want to do all three. And so in the early days, I was doing research and teaching. And then when I started to do therapy, Isidore Fromm, who was Fritz and Laura's, they were his mentors, and he was he had the reputation of being the best Gestalt therapist. He became my therapist, and he said he'd never seen anyone develop a practice so quickly. So I don't know how it happened, really, to be honest, but it did happen very fast, and I was clear when I started to practice that I wasn't going to lie about who I was. But when I was teaching, I had to lie, because if I had said I was gay, I would have been fired.
Yes.
So, I mean, that was New York in the 1950s.
Right.
1960s, so I couldn't be honest. But when I started to practice, I didn't have an institution I had to be to lie to. And in my private practice, I never said I'm not gay. I didn't hang out a sign that said I am gay. Mm-hmm. If anybody asked me, I always told them. Most of the people I saw were referred to me by other people who I had been seeing. So I think that was probably part of what they told him before they came.
Right.
John said he didn't know when he, John Drimmer, who you mentioned earlier.
Yes, yes.
But that he asked me in the first session, was I gay? And I said yes. And that was the concern of his, that when he left, he said he thought about it and he felt that I had been so direct and honest with him and that there was so much liveliness in the session that he could overlook it. But it was an issue for him.
Yeah. Now, so when your practice takes off, that was before Stonewall, I believe, and the whole...
Oh, yes, way before Stonewall.
Yeah, before Stonewall and the whole gay liberation movement. And then Stonewall comes along, which all of our listeners may not be familiar with that, but it was a time of rebellion against persecution of gays in New York City, right, in Greenwich Village?
Right. Right, it started on the night Judy Garland died.
Oh.
And it started with drag queens in the Stonewall Bar, the Stonewall Inn Bar, and the cops were being offensive, and somehow the drag queens decided they weren't going to put up with any more. It was spontaneous, and they fought the cops, and there was a riot. And there was a lot of publicity about it.
And
it was the beginning of gay liberation.
Yes. So what was... go ahead.
From my point of view, was the Gestalt therapist who was in the Gestalt milieu. I was on the board of directors of the Gestalt Institute of New York, and I think, if I recall correctly, every one of the male members of the board, except one, were gay. Nobody cared about being gay. I mean, it was already liberated.
Mm-hmm.
So Stonewall was something that happened in the larger culture, but in the smaller cultures, it already happened.
So what was the difference?
You follow me there.
Yes, I do. What was the difference for you, both as a man and as a therapist, before and after that pivotal event of gay liberation in Stonewall?
Well, you know, maybe it's my failing. I mean, I understand Stonewall in the larger culture, and that it was a dramatic event in which gays said to the police and to the larger society, we're not going to take it anymore, and we demand our rights. But in another way, that had already happened in the liberal Greenwich Village bohemian atmosphere and in the liberal circles in New York. So there's a difference between what the event meant in the larger culture and what it didn't mean in the smaller culture.
Right.
In the smaller culture, it had already transpired.
Yes, it had already transpired for you in your life, even though it hadn't in the larger culture.
Right.
Did you notice differences in your clientele, though, before and after?
For the most part, no. I was already running a gay group in New York. I think it was the first gay group in New York. I did a little research, but I didn't do exhaustive. I mean, what difference to make whether it was the first or the second? But my understanding, it was the first. So it was already a liberationist kind of thing. There were a couple of patients who were, I really think they were more troubled than some of the others. And for them, it was very important that Stonewall provided them with a kind of platform that they felt more secure. But I saw a lot of people who are professionals, and they had already, I think, when they came to see me, although what they might have been suffering from the prejudice and the stigma in the larger culture, they were more comfortable in their own sense with being gay.
Mm-hmm. And in the larger culture, the larger gay culture, there was a period of jubilant freedom for the gay community, but then the AIDS pandemic struck, and I'm under the impression that you've done a lot of work with gay men suffering from AIDS. So let's talk about that a little bit. What did you learn through that?
Well, I mean, the AIDS thing, I'm Jewish, so when I was young, the Holocaust was happening. And it was ghastly. One of my early memories, I mean, I was of age, I remember very clearly when refugees started coming over from Europe when I was about 10 years old and how horrible it was. And then I remember when the Second World War started and Germany invaded Poland, and I had relatives who died in the gas chambers in Poland. Well, as for a Jew, the Holocaust is a ghastly experience. Well, then later in life, here I am practicing as a therapist with a clientele, one-third of whom were gay, and with a gay group. And the AIDS epidemic comes along. One of the first 25 people who was listed as having died from AIDS was one of my patients.
Mm.
And in New York City and San Francisco, I think those were the two hardest hit. Well, it was ghastly. It was like another kind of Holocaust. And I can't say it was decimated, because decimated technically means 1 out of 10. Well, it wasn't 1 out of 10. I counted up at one point. I looked at the gay patients I had, and then the number of them who either died or who had HIV infections, and it came to between 30% and 40%. And that's what the statistic was, presumably for what the gay population of San Francisco was. Well, if you can imagine having 30% to 40% of your gay patients either infected or dying, how horrible that was.
Yes.
It was just nightmarish. And the gay group stopped. There were so many people who died.
Oh, my God.
There were a handful of us left. And we had been to so many funerals and had meetings of the group in hospital bedrooms. And we just looked at one another, and we said, what do we do? And there were 3 or 4 of us left, and we said, we just better stop. The group was hardly left.
Oh, my God.
It was nightmarish. And it's much better now with all the antiviral drugs, and people survive. But I saw one of the members of that group recently, and he said, "Do you remember when we went to visit Tim in his hotel room, and he was dying, and you and I came out, and how we both wept?"
And how are you? I assume that maybe you still had individual clients even after the group broke up, who were suffering from AIDS.
Oh yes, yes. And when I had patients who were infected, if they stopped working, they couldn't pay me. That was fine, but it was just terrible to, instead of being able to treat people and see them live happy lives or successful lives, instead you were being a witness to their death and helping them die.
What kept you going? How did you keep from caving in yourself? I mean, it just sounds like it.
Well, what else could one do? I was happy I wasn't infected myself.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel I could abandon those people. How did the people survive in the concentration camps? You know, I don't know how they survived in the camps, and I wasn't in a camp, but I just did what I could to get through it. And at least most of my patients weren't gay, and they weren't dying, but it was a terrible, terrible, difficult time.
It certainly sounds like it. And you mentioned that about, really, it was only about a third of your clientele were gay, so that would suggest that about two-thirds of your patients were straight. What's it like?
Right.
You know, so what's it like to be a gay man working with straight clients? Are there any advantages or disadvantages?
Yes, it was an advantage. I think a lot of women felt very comfortable with it. They didn't feel threatened sexually. They didn't feel they either had to come on to me, or they weren't afraid I was going to come on to them. The whole sexual tension between male and female was lessened, and I think it was an asset
mm-hmm.
for them. A lot of gay men have straight women friends. People have written about it, and I think they appreciated the sexual thing was put to bed.
Yeah.
There were a couple of straight women who wanted to seduce me, who wanted to have my child and so on, but that was rare. But most of them were, I think, accepting that this was an asset for them.
What about with straight men patients?
Well, I think a straight man also didn't feel as competitive about, and a lot of the straight men confessed to me either their gay experiences or their gay feelings. I don't know whether they were trying to be friendly. I don't know whether they were trying to be accepting, but I was impressed with how many of the straight men I saw, unbidden by me, brought up their homosexual feelings or experiences or desires.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there was one man who was married and had two children, and he told me every night before he went to sleep, he had a fantasy about having a sexual encounter with another man. Now, it wasn't an important part of his life. It was sort of encapsulated. But I felt it was easier for him to bring this up with a gay therapist rather than a straight one.
Mm-hmm. Was it harder for you in terms of counter-transference, you know, straight male therapists sometimes have to wrestle with their sexual attraction to female clients, and of course there are documented instances where they failed to do so and ended up getting sued and all sorts of things happen.
Well, how was I that? Always used to say that there are so many attractive men in the world. Why on earth would I have to focus on my patients?
Mm-hmm.
There were so many others who I could put my attention on, and that it was therefore counterproductive to really make them the focus of my desires.
Okay. And by contrast of working with straight patients, how was your experience different when you were working with gay clients?
Well, sometimes there weren't any differences. I mean, people are people, and if you're sort of relaxed about it, that's so. I do think one of the differences in the gay group was that there was a stronger sense of community. The way the, say, the African-American caucus in Congress feels it has a special sort of place in the Congress, that they're not just equal, but they're special because they're the objects of prejudice and discrimination. I think the gay group had a certain elan in that way, that here was a group of gay men who were confronting gay issues together, and that they felt a certain kinship with one another, whereas in a straight group, it would be more diverse kind of background.
Mm-hmm. You say that you know, at root we're all people. Do you think a straight therapist though can be effective with gay clients?
Well, Laura Pearls was straight, and she was certainly quite effective with me, as far as I'm concerned. And you know, I mean, it's like saying, can male patients work with a female? Can females work with a male patient? Can straight patients work with a gay therapist? Can gay therapists work with a straight patient? I think really, if you have a little bit of imagination and a little bit of courage and a little bit of experience, those differences can be overcome.
I think
some lesbians, I didn't see too many. I think they wanted to see a gay woman rather than a gay man. And so I thought, all right, if that's who they're more comfortable with, then let it be.
Okay, let's shift a little bit then from to talk about change. What's your view of how change happens? Or do you have a theory of change?
Well, no, I don't. I think it's a miracle in a way. I do think it happens in a lot of different ways, but I think one of the ways that I would like it to happen is that the person takes something in and lets it make a difference. I talk sometimes about the sieve, where I worked with some people, some of them very gifted therapists, and I would say something, and they could hear it, and they could repeat it, and it was like it went in one ear and out the other. Could they remember what I said? Yes. Could they repeat it? Yes. Did it make any difference? No. So there was some kind of internal process that had to make that had to take place that made a difference. Now, sometimes because of Gestalt techniques, you could sort of perform Gestalt experiments, and sometimes that gave people a kind of insight and a sharpening and a quickness. But still, they had to let something happen inside that shifted for them so they could let go of what Laura Pearls always used to call fixed Gestalt. Sort of tightness and traditional ways of responding. We always talked about doing experiments and taking risks.
Mm-hmm.
Some way, trying out new different kinds of behaviors that would permit people to let something different happen.
Yes, yes. You know, we have a certain number of students who listen to this series. What would be your advice to someone who's thinking of becoming a therapist?
Well, I guess to go in therapy themselves so they can learn about themselves. I think that we're all very blind about ourselves. And I was in psychoanalysis before I was in Gestalt therapy, and I remember the psychoanalyst telling me he was going on vacation, and I was very rebellious, and I said, well, that's fine. It means I'll have a month when I won't have to see you. And I'm saying this to him, and tears are going down my face. Now, on a conscious level, what I meant was, that's good that you're going away. And somewhere underneath, something else was happening for me, and I was totally blind to it. Mm-hmm. Now, I think I'm using that as a kind of illustration of how blind we can be about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think the experience of being in therapy is where you really learn in a very personal, intimate, direct way how blind you can be about who you are or what your feelings are. And if you're going to be a therapist, the better you know yourself, I think the better it is to be open to how other people can need understanding and wisdom and a larger point of view.
Okay, so this hypothetical student should go out and find a therapist. What's your advice in terms of shopping for a therapist? How does one best go about that?
Well, one is to ask friends, and the other is to have interviews and see what happens in the first interview you have, and if you don't like somebody, better not go to them. I think it's very important that the patient has some positive feelings for the therapist.
Okay, good. So thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Dan Rosenblatt. I was very interested in his perspective and insights into places like Harvard and Greenwich Village during the era of the 1950s. Now in his 80s, he has a perspective on how both therapeutic mores and attitudes toward gays have changed over the past 60 years. What a harrowing experience it must have been for Dr. Rosenblatt to watch so many friends and patients waste away and die due to AIDS. Even with recent advances in treating HIV, AIDS is still a plague and it continues to spread. Although he didn't speak of it, I think there is some fear that young men in this country are less careful than they were during the height of the AIDS crisis. The fact that there are drug cocktails that extend life may give the impression that it's not that big a deal anymore. That would be a mistake. As wonderful as these drugs are, I've recently learned that they also frequently have negative long-term effects on various organs and functions of the body. We can only hope that more funding for AIDS research will be made available to put an end to this epidemic. As you heard, his first experience of therapy was with Laura Pearls. Her one-time husband, Fritz Pearls, is generally credited as the founder of Gestalt Therapy. I don't know the details of their marital history, but evidently pretty early on after coming to this country, they went their separate ways, with Laura settling in New York City and Fritz making a big splash at Esalen and other points on the West Coast. As a consequence, there are two fairly distinct flavors of Gestalt Therapy: East Coast Gestalt and West Coast Gestalt. As a West Coaster myself, I'm most familiar with that flavor, having had the opportunity to see Fritz himself work in person and on film, and also many of his students. Fritz was extremely flamboyant and theatrical, and that definitely flavored his approach. He was very insistent that clients not go into stories about the past and that they stay in the here and now. I have no direct experience of the East Coast style, but I've been told that it's more conversational and less theatrical. I would have liked to explore these differences more with Dr. Dan, but I hope to have opportunities in the future to do so with some of the other pioneers of Gestalt, if I move forward swiftly enough while they're still around. So many to interview, so little time.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
We're very pleased to be sponsored by Podshow and GoDaddy. Use the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout to get a great deal on a domain name. And don't forget, you can purchase the first 50 Shrink Wrap Radio shows on 2 MP3 CDs for a fairly nominal price. Might save you a lot of downloading time if you've just discovered the show. Just go to www.poddisc.com. That's P-O-D-D-I-S-C. If you haven't filled it out yet, you'll find our listener survey at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And also, there's a link on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And if you include your name and email address, you'll get a little surprise. We have two new additions to our Frapper Map, and I want to give a big thank you and a welcome to Capuchin from Paris, France, and Alan in Hong Kong.
Have I been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio, or is it really all in my mind?
Okay, let's see if we can catch up on a bit of back mail. Nir in New York writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I've just listened to the program called Irish Odyssey." Well, you're a bit behind. That was a long time ago, but I'm glad you're catching up. One of the questions you raised was, how or where does the journey end? I feel that the journey ends with enlightenment, which is also the purpose and goal of life. What's the definition of enlightenment? It's a state of perfection, of complete joy and wholeness, complete knowledge and understanding, of responding to life and to others with complete compassion and love in any situation. Some people throughout history have reached such a state, such as the Buddha, Moses, Jesus, and probably many ordinary people that we don't know about. What I also heard you say in the interview is that there are cycles on the path. I agree. It seems to me that these cycles are progressive, going through levels of descents and ascents, leading to stages of enlightenment occurring in sequence throughout the process. The more one goes down into emptiness, darkness, the more one then goes up into bliss. The more one works on oneself, the faster one progresses through these cycles. The reason for all this and the explanation of these cycles is found in the Kabbalah, which explains this as interactions of vessels being filled with light and then being emptied of it in order for the vessel, desire, to grow and become capable of containing even more light the next time around. As you can probably tell, I'm quite into the Kabbalah, and the truth is that I was quite obsessed with it for about a year. I've now moved on, but I've learned some amazing things from my Kabbalah journey, and it gave me some answers that could not be found in any other source, going to such deep levels in which all known sciences merge into simple processes of two forces, light and dark. Desire to give and desire to receive, the two forces that are the root of everything that exists. I hope I'm not sounding strange, and I hope we could discuss this sometime. Nir. Nir, thanks for those comments, and no, you don't sound strange. I actually agree with most of what you said, maybe even all of it. It was as a result of your interest in Kabbalah that I located Rabbi Weiss for our recent show on Kabbalah. And yes, I do believe our progress is in cycles. Actually, I believe it's in a spiral pattern, which is kind of what you allude to, in which we keep confronting the same issues, but at higher and higher levels. And speaking of the Kabbalah interview with Rabbi Weiss, David in Manila writes, "Hi, Dave. Thanks for another great show. Rabbi Weiss was a hugely interesting guest. Viva Shrink Wrap Radio, David. And next, Lloyd in Australia and I exchanged a series of emails about the desirability or the undesirability of fame. And I think this was triggered by the interview with Randy Gage on How to Get Rich. Lloyd and I both confessed that we wouldn't mind a certain level of fame. Here's what he says in one of his emails on this subject. Dr. Dave, often I ask people if they want to be famous, and to my surprise, they nearly always say no. If it wasn't for that, I would have assumed the desire to be universal. But since it isn't, perhaps it is something genuine that should be heeded. I would like to be famous in the same way as, for example, Stanley Kubrick. By the way, I had asked him in an earlier email if he wanted to be famous, what would he want to be famous for? And so he's responding to that. He says, I would like to be famous in the same way as, for example, Stanley Kubrick or Aldous Huxley. They have had world fame, but by name only. That way you can keep your anonymity when you want it. That said, I'm not adverse to my face being known. I think unless you are famous for your face, you don't get that celebrity-type fame. I'm married anyway, so all those screaming girls would go to waste. The fields I can imagine myself becoming famous in are writing and movie directing, probably writing first. I believe I have something to say that will resonate with the right people in the area of philosophy, self-help, and religion. However, I'm not sure it's ready to be written just yet. I want it to be something that I need to say, that forces itself out of me. I don't want to write for the sake of writing. There are already enough many books in the world. If it never comes, then I'm happy that it wasn't my calling, and that's that. Anyway, you're further down that track than me. I'm sure your show will continue to grow in popularity, and then more opportunities to branch out will arise. Do you have a master plan, or just take it as it comes? Best regards, Lloyd. Lloyd, I am just taking it as it comes. I have no master plan. I take the opportunities as they come. And it just so happens an opportunity to branch out with my podcasting has come along. I'll talk about that on the next show. In the meantime, I'll leave you all in suspense. Don't worry, though, Shrink Wrap Radio is not going away. Next, we hear from Michelle in Paris. Hi, Dr. Dave. I don't know if you remember me. You have so many admirers. I'm Michelle, your only, I believe, Parisian listener. I wanted to wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas and a great New Year, in which I hope you will continue to bring us many more fascinating podcasts. I also wanted to mention an idea I had to help you fund the show. When I was asked to make up a list of things I wanted for Christmas, I remembered that one of the things I wanted doesn't exist yet. I would love to have a CD collection of your interviews. Hey, how wonderful that that was a Christmas wish of yours. She goes on, I've often thought of doing it myself, but I would want to cut out the ads at the beginning and the responses to emails, etc. at the end, which would require a fair amount of work. I don't mean to say that the responses at the end can't be interesting, but if I were to make up CDs, I would only take the interview itself and your comments following. What do you think? You could sell them on your website. You could list the subject and the name of the person interviewed. I'm not sure how you would work out the royalties with your guests, but I'm sure there are standard rules about that sort of thing. Not only would I buy a set for myself, but I would certainly want to offer them to many different friends who are not necessarily into listening to podcasts, but who I know would love your show. If you think it's a good idea and it's possible, I want to be the first to know. If you don't think it will work, please let me know so I can get to work on burning my own set. Have a wonderful New Year and thank you for everything you bring to so many people. Kindest regards, Michelle. And then she goes on, P.S. I've started my master's in psychology and haptopsychotherapy, and I'm loving it. Well, Michelle, initially you were the only listener in Paris, but I think we now have two or three more. Perhaps you've been spreading the word there. And as for making the interviews available on CD, I've taken your suggestion to heart, and as mentioned earlier on this show, the first 50 interviews are available on two CDs from www.podcast.com. poddisc.com. That's P-O-D-D-I-S-C. However, I have to say that the emails are on there. That part was not removed. I think the commercials aren't on there. The commercial that comes on just before the show begins, those are not on there. Okay, and then I was happy to hear from Lynn, who attended the Esalen workshop that Ron Alexander and I recently did together. And Lynn writes, "Dave, I love your site and enjoyed our weekend at Esalen with Ron. Do you have an email list to notify of new interviews, etc.? Please add me on. Love, Lynn." Lynn, that's a great suggestion. I don't currently send out a newsletter announcing the latest shows. I may do that at some point, and if anyone else is interested in that, be sure to take our listener survey and put your email address on it, because if I ever do create a shrink wrap newsletter, those are the addresses I will use. So that's probably enough email for today. I'll wrap it up here. I do love getting your emails, and you can write to me at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod. And you're also encouraged to leave voice messages or little transitions like the one you heard earlier on MyChingo, and you'll find the logo for that. Just click on the logo on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Now, I think on the last two or three shows, I've actually been giving out the wrong phone number. So if you did leave a message, and I haven't received any, I didn't get it because I was giving out the wrong phone number. So the right one, again, is 206-337-0622. I would love to get some voice messages that I could play on the show. Let's see. And as I've said before, my biggest challenge is growing the audience. So please let all your friends, professors, family, etc. know about it if you think they remotely might be interested in it. Thanks again to Dr. Dan Rosenblatt for the interview. Our next show will be with Dr. Darwin Church, co-author of a new book called Soul Medicine. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.